This is 10 CA 1846. It is the case that we have referred to as the writ of attachment case, and I'll give counsel a couple minutes, or you know, so that you can get ready. Understand that you've got to change gears a little bit here.
Thank you.
Certainly. Mr. Croft, thank you very much. Again, for the record, because we're having separate arguments, if counsel would be so kind as to enter their appearances here, too.
I am Gary Craw, Your Honors, and I represent the plaintiffs and the appellants. I've already given you a brief summary of the facts, but I think some of the key timeline facts to this second issue are that the settlement with Parkview Hospital was reached on January 13, 2010. The trial began on February 9th, 3 weeks later. The settlement had not been paid. The trial went for 3 weeks, and the verdict was returned on February 26, 2010. So that's 6 weeks after a settlement was made, the settlement was not paid. Judgment was entered for the defendants on March 3rd, and an ex parte motion for attachment was filed on March 5th. That was before, and it was based on the alleged debt for costs. At that point, there had been no motion for new trial ruled upon, nor even filed. At that point, there had been no motion for an award of costs granted or even filed. And then we come to the hearings, the first on March 12, 2010, where the defendants repudiated the affidavit they used to obtain the attachment and said, no, the plaintiffs didn't say that they were going to take the money and hide it. The plaintiff's attorney, me, did it. They made that allegation. Well, the trial judge, seeing the problem, and I agreed with him, immediately directed me to get counsel because now I was going to have to be a witness in the case, and I did. And we went through a series of three hearings where evidence was taken, and on July 9th, 2010, the trial judge ruled that the prejudgment attachment was discharged and dismissed. Now, review here is the first issue, the standard of review, and it's clear that this involves the interpretation of a rule or a statute. Fagan versus Alexa, Colorado Supreme Court 2001, said interpretation of such things is a question of law. Crandall versus City and County of Denver, Colorado Supreme Court 2010 says whether a statute or rule mandates attorney fees is a question of interpretation to be reviewed de novo. Now, when you review this situation, excuse me, I'm a little nervous. I don't do this on a regular basis. When you review this de novo, it's undisputable on the record that the grounds alleged to support an attachment were Rule 102 C7 and 8, which are basically presently about to convey, transfer, assign, conceal, or dispose of money that was owed. The Parkview settlement is what they were trying to apply that to in this case. Now, the undisputed testimony, oh, and that for the record is it. The hearing of 7, 9, 10 in the order of the judge, transcript to page 22, lines 10 to 13.
Mr. Carr, I want to ask you a kind of a threshold question here. Your motion, which was titled Plaintiff's Application to Discharge Writ of Attachment, expressly references that it's filed under CRCP 102W. And I know we've got a dispute here on appeal about whether the court's order was under subsection N or subsection W, but I want to focus on W for a minute, because your motion was framed under that rule, and the court entered at least one of the orders that you're arguing about here, which is he discharged it. He specifically said he discharged it under subsection W. But there's a couple of other words in that rule that nobody's talking about. Talks about a motion, like your motion, if you're going to file under that subsection, being filed before trial. This motion was filed after trial. So how are any of these proceedings, including your motion, even valid if they don't meet the test that the motion had to be filed before trial?
I think that's an excellent point, and I've wondered throughout these proceedings if the prejudgment attachment rule was ever intended to apply to a situation like this, where really what we're talking about is the insurance company behind the prevailing defendants are trying to recover costs post-verdict.
Well, that's another issue, and Judge Bernard talked about that in terms of what we want to hear from you in the supplemental briefs. But I'm just talking just in terms of the pure timing here. Why does Rule 102W apply at all here?
I don't think it does.
So why'd you file your motion under that rule?
Because I had to do something, Your Honor, to help my clients. If you look at the sequence of events, I filed that immediately upon learning of the prejudgment attachment. Before I had counsel. Then we had the March 12th, 10 hearing, and then they changed the allegations saying that I had done something untoward. The judge said I needed to have counsel because I was now a witness, and then Mr. Posner took over for me, and Mr. Posner said, I shouldn't say what he said, but then my clients filed an affidavit, which was a traverse. Then we had traverse hearings, and the court, in both its written order and in its ruling from the verbal order from the bench, said in three places, and I can give you the references if you need them, that this is a hearing on a traverse.
That's what I hear you saying is, as a result of this, the rest of the procedural history, your initial motion, which is filed under subsection W, kind of goes by the wayside. Is that your position?
Well, it was heard on March 12th, and it wasn't ruled on. The judge heard it and didn't decide it. But that my whole point is that I believe that W is meant to be a screening device, much like a summary judgment motion, where either the face of the pleadings show there's no basis for the attachment, or the proceedings, like something like the answer that you file to the petition says, well, the plaintiff has died. You know, so, well, now you've got to get an estate opened, and, you know, if you're going to attach the plaintiff's money, it's got to be with the name of another party or something. So when it's a situation where on the face of the proceedings, without a hearing, you can just discharge the petition for attachment, it should be done, and that's what W is about. The critical difference, I think, is that subsection N says that, or provides for a due process hearing, promptly within 7 days after the issuance of a prejudgment attachment. And it provides for a hearing where subsection W does not. And the reason for that is to comport with the requirements of due process of law.
Mr. Krah, when the court held the hearing on N, it was to address the allegations in the affidavit, was it not? The substantive allegations, which would have been made under C, 7, and 8?
On March 12th, the first hearing, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
All right. And so the court, when it issued its ruling, it determined that the allegations were not met.
Well, no, it didn't. If you look at the actual ruling of the judge, what he says is the court is going to discharge and dismiss, and he always uses both words. I know there's been some argument about semantics in the briefs. Always uses both words, discharge and dismiss. But the reason he did is ultimately at the traverse hearing, the testimony came out that my client and I had never received the money. We never had the present ability to transfer or convey it. That's why on de novo review, I think the record is indisputably clear that you can find that they never met their burden of proof. But further, kind of lost my train of thought. I think that conclusively proves, you know, if you review this de novo, as I feel you must, that they never met their burden of proof. We never had the money. The money was held for reasons unknown for more than 12 weeks. I never received it by Parkview and their attorney. And why they held it, I don't know. But if you don't have the money, you don't have the possibility of presently, the present ability to do anything improper with the money.
Mr. Crowe, the rule doesn't say present ability, but it says presently about to. And so what do the words about to mean?
It means they should have, if they were going to use an attachment and this whole procedure applies, they should have served it on the attorney for it's Ms. Mitchell, the attorney representing Dr. Rickman. Oh, no, excuse me, Ms. Mitchell, the attorney representing Parkview Hospital, who had entered into a settlement with us. They should have served it on her, not on us, if this whole process even applies. There's no question here that the judge ruled and found that this attachment was discharged and dismissed. The rule of construction that applies, it says, if a statute or rule is clear, courts must apply the plain and ordinary meaning. The damages rule says a plaintiff in attachment, here the Copic defendants, who fails to prevail at the hearing, doesn't say for this reason or that reason, provided in this section, and that's the Traverse hearing, which the judge three times said this was, is liable for any damages sustained, period. Justice Bender from the Supreme Court in Vanderbeek versus Vernon spoke specifically about that phrase in the rule, and he said, and I quote from that case at page 877, I conclude that the rule means what it says, and that the injured defendant in attachment can recover any damages he can prove.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Crowe. That was not the court's majority opinion, correct?
I believe that was a dissent or a concurrence by Justice Bender.
So that does not, a majority of the court has not endorsed that position. Is that fair to say?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
The argument that we were not the prevailing party, well, the Supreme Court said in Spencer versus Aurora, prevailing party is the party that prevails on the disputed main issue. In the second part of the case, the disputed main issue is the validity of the prejudgment attachment. So to argue that the plaintiffs, or defendant in attachment, the plaintiffs, here did not prevail is simply nonsense, as is that discharge versus dismiss semantic argument. It's a distinction without a difference, where in all the rulings, both verbally and written, the judge said he is discharging and dismissing this attachment. For more than 100 years, our Supreme Court has held that if an attachment is issued and it fails at the Traverse hearing, and we had a Traverse hearing in this case, and it failed there because they said that the money was not subject to attachment because of a prior attorney's lien, the plaintiff in attachment must pay all damages. Now, in construing W and N, what seems to be a conflict, the rule of construction is to try to harmonize and give meaning and effect to both parts. And these rules show, based on what I said about there not being a hearing provision in subsection W, and there being a explicit provision for a due process hearing in subsection N, show that this was a Traverse hearing. The defendants, in this case, did not prevail on their prejudgment attachment, and they are liable for all damages incurred by us. I was lucky enough and honored enough to have good enough partners that had the trust and faith in me to say to Copic, we're going to fight this. This is enough bullying and intimidation of people who've gone through a trial with them. And they supported it to the tune of $100,000. And we have not been reimbursed. We paid that out of our pocket to bring this matter before this court. Thank you.
So you've got about 2:20 left, a little bit over.
Thank you, Your Honors. Hello again. Todd Drake on behalf of the appellees, Dr. Johnson and Dr. King. To go to the first point, the last thing that was said by Mr. Craw, these fees were not incurred by the plaintiff in this case. They're incurred by Mr. Craw and Mr. Craw's law firm. Any argument related to whether the attachment should have been made, whether the traverse was proper, whether the discharge was proper, all that is essentially moot. There are no damages that the plaintiff sustained in this case. The damages that Mr. Craw just articulated, this idea that his firm had to pay $100,000, is essentially that they had to go pay to have someone enforce a lien, enforce their statutory attorney's lien, and their claim that they had priority over those settlement proceeds. They could have done that, Your Honors, without a traverse, without the challenge of the attachment. In fact, they did file their lien very early on, and that was the basis that the court ultimately decided to discharge the writ. It did not dismiss the writ under Rule 102N. These are not semantic differences between dismissal and discharge. The dismissal, Rule 102N, is the only basis under this rule, under Colorado law, under anything upon which the plaintiff, not Mr. Crossman, but the plaintiff, could claim damages and attorney's fees. It's the only basis. So going back to some of the initial questions in terms of whether or not, Judge Loeb, whether or not the plaintiff's motion requesting a discharge of this case, whether or not the court even could properly discharge it, that would also apply under Rule 102N. The Rule 102N states also at the beginning that any time before trial, you may file a traverse. So if we're accepting Mr. Crowell's position that no, it was not proper to discharge the writ under 102W, it's also similarly not proper that there was ever any discussion of a traverse of the affidavit, a traverse of this writ of attachment. And without that, this really is a moot point. That is the sole basis under which plaintiffs sought fees. It's the sole basis that he can ever get fees. There is no other statutory basis under Colorado law. Mr. Crowell talked about them being the prevailing party, the plaintiff being the prevailing party in the case. It's admitted that clearly is a abuse of discretion standard. There's a whole line of cases talk about when parties prevail on separate issues, it's up to the trial court to decide. But regardless, prevailing party only goes to cost. It doesn't go to attorney's fees. The issue of who prevailed, there's no contractual fee-shifting provision here which would go to whether who was the prevailing party. So I understand the court's hesitation, or I shouldn't say hesitation, but questioning of this process. I would agree, Your Honors, that the rule as written does not, it certainly contemplates the idea of doing this when a plaintiff files a lawsuit and says, the property from which we intend to recover our damages at the end, we're worried that that's going to be transferred somewhere. But there's nothing within the rule, Your Honors, that precludes a court from doing it after the trial. There's nothing that precludes it from being for a cost judgment. I would agree that as written, where it suggests that it must be done before trial, Judge Loeb, it's difficult to reconcile that. What I would suggest to the court is that what the rule implies is that at any time before there is a decision on the underlying claim and on this writ, then you can challenge it. The cost that Copic, the defendants in this case, were trying to collect had actually not been decided yet. The legal basis and the fact that they were legally entitled to cost had been decided. The court had indicated it was going to award costs, had directed the defense to submit bill of costs, but had not yet been decided. So in terms of that, in terms of the trial, I would submit that one reading of this is that until the decision on the underlying debt has been decided. And that's an important factor in this as well, Yours. I think this goes to as well, back to Rule 102N, which is the rule we have to be talking about in terms of the attorney's fees, because regardless of whether the writ should have been issued in the first place, regardless of whether or not the traverse was proper, all these things, the discharge was proper, if Rule 102N, if the traverse plaintiffs did not prevail on that, they cannot recover any attorney's fees. The court specifically found that the plaintiff did not prevail on the traverse. That's all over the record. It's Mr. Crawl would have this court essentially engage in a new evidentiary a review of this to say that no, his clients were the ones who actually wanted that traverse. It wasn't the defendants. You know, that's where I'd submit, and perhaps I didn't articulate this the best in our brief, but in terms of the standard of review, I don't disagree that in reviewing a rule like this, it is a de novo review in terms of the legal interpretation of that rule and how that rule is applied. But in terms of the factual findings that were made by the trial court, including, as went out Judge Lichtenstein, the fact that the court specifically found the defendants in this case demonstrated a reasonable probability that the plaintiffs at some time, if not presently, in the very near present, were going to try and transfer these funds to someone in an attempt to hinder the defendant's ability to collect those.
Let me ask about that for a minute. Is that what the court found, or did the court find that, I guess it was Mr. May or whoever the lawyer was, had a reasonable belief that that might happen? That's different than saying, I find that there was a reasonable probability that these folks were going to fraudulently transfer some property. So which was it that the court found?
I believe the court found both, Your Honor. I agree there is a distinction between those two, and the court spoke of it in terms of both. It spoke about that Mr. May had the subjective belief that the plaintiffs were going to do that. Based on that, the court found that the defendants had demonstrated that there was a reasonable probability. The court even said, he acknowledged that Mr. May had been wrong in that belief, but regardless, based on the affidavit, based on the testimony that was submitted at the Travers hearing, the trial court specifically found that the causes, the basis for issuing the writ of attachment under 102C and 102C7 and 102C8 had specifically been met. And it was based on that. And again, to go back to the language of the rule, Your Honor, it's very clear that really the focus, and the trial court makes this finding, but I don't think it was the focus of the trial court, but the real issue in terms of a traverse under 102N is this a debt that is due? Because that is really the idea with, I believe this idea with Rule 102 and the purpose of being able to challenge a writ of attachment is issued is, and permitting a party to recover attorney's fees in a very specific, narrow way, is if you have parties out there attaching funds or attaching assets to which they have no valid debt, or to which there is no reasonable probability, that would be a problem. That would be a basis for the other party then to challenge it and to recover their fees. They should recover their fees if there's no basis and there's no debt. However, here, both those were established. The defendants were entitled to cost. They knew that was coming. They knew they had a legal entitlement. The court specifically found this debt was valid, that the defendants had every reason to accept that that was a valid debt. And they had reason, based on Mr. May's testimony and his affidavit, they had reason to believe that they would be unable to collect that debt because the settlement proceeds that were being received from Parkview Hospital were going to be transferred to other parties who were not parties to this action. I should say other individuals that were not parties to this action.
Sure, Drake, let me ask you this. Could you respond to Mr. Craw's argument that even the courts, although the court was saying it discharged the writ under W on the basis of the attorney lien, that it actually was dissolving the writ under N because evidence of the amount of the attorney lien only came out during the traverse hearing?
Thank you, Your Honor. 2 points to that. First of all, it was not based solely on evidence at the traverse hearing. The lien itself had been filed. One of the arguments that the appellant makes in this is that a discharge under 102W is only based on facial defects within the writ, or within the papers, is actually what the rule talks about. Papers that were submitted to the court include that notice of the attorney's lien. That is a basis standing alone upon which the court could say, okay, this firm has priority, the law firm has priority to those funds. But more specifically to Mr. Craw's argument that the discharge somehow equates with something under 102N, a dismissal under 102, or a dissolution. We kind of keep using the same words in a way that suggests that they're equivalent. They're not. A dismissal of the writ of attachment under 102N is what must be shown. It specifically talks about in the rule that if the debt for which the action is brought is not due, the action shall be dismissed. That's 102N. That's the basis on which you get dismissal. A discharge essentially under 102W is, I would argue, it's almost a catch-all. It's not, I don't believe it's a screening device, as Mr. Cross suggests, but what it is if there is some other basis, aside from the challenge of the affidavit, aside from this factual challenge to the underlying basis for issuing the writ in the first place, then the court may look to discharge it. And that's exactly what, as you point out, Judge Loeb, that's exactly what the plaintiffs asked for in this case. They filed a traverse, they challenged Mr. May's affidavit. They said, we challenge and don't believe there's any basis for you to have said that we were going to disperse these funds. The court found against them on that. They also, as a separate thing, asked for discharge. They specifically asked for this discharge. The court granted it to them. The plaintiffs even acknowledged in their, they filed a motion in the trial court asking that he somehow amend that judgment. And in that motion, they specifically said, we agree that the discharge was proper. So to come now and suggest that, no, this wasn't a discharge, it was actually a dismissal, or that the discharge that the trial court did enter was somehow an improper thing, I think that's inappropriate. I shouldn't say inappropriate, strong word, but I don't think that's consistent with what they argued at the trial court.
Rick, if I may ask you a hypothetical, please. Let's assume that there was no 102W, and at the time that the plaintiff came in with the traverse, they said the defendants should not prevail here because there's an attorney lien in place, and the attorney lien makes very clear, and it takes care of this issue. And let's say the court had at that point said, I agree with you. And while I understand that it was reasonable for Mr. May to reach this conclusion, now I see that there is no way for this money to go to the defendants. And so it at that point, it decides that, we are going to dismiss this. What? Would your position be different?
Well, going back to my position would not be different, Your Honor. And I would submit that that's exactly what they should have and could have done in this case. They didn't have to challenge it by a traverse. They could have simply said, we have priority over these funds. The plaintiff has no recovery of these funds. You're attaching something that doesn't exist. Is essentially
all right. If they say that, they get relief like they did here, right?
They would get a dissolution of it. They would not get dismissal of the writ under the traverse, under 102N. It's only 102N that talks about dismissal. And so, no, I don't agree that if they'd come in and said, we have priority, which is what they did. They said, we have priority, that means that they got dismissal or could get dismissal of the writ. It would essentially be outside of the context of 102. It would be instead this claim of priority over the funds.
All right, what if instead they had said and assumed that the court was satisfied with this, that we don't have the funds? Different result, same result.
In terms of saying the plaintiff saying we don't, and we'll never be entitled to.
That's right.
I think had they done that, it would not be a different result in terms of the ruling that plaintiffs weren't entitled to attorney's fees, because that's ultimately what the court did decide here. I think it's broken out into essentially those two separate issues. They had the traverse over here. The traverse is the sole basis on which they're requesting those fees, the only basis they can get those fees. They didn't prevail on the traverse. So that's really the only question that has to be addressed in terms of that. On these other issues, in terms of was it discharge proper, could they have just said, look, there's nothing to attach. We don't have these, the settlement funds, we'll never have them. And the court said, okay, I'm going to go ahead and just get rid and dissolve this writ at this point. Yes, they could have, but it would not have given rise to a basis for attorney's fees.
Is there any issue of mootness here?
Your Honor, I do think, and as I started my argument, I do think, yes, that the concept that if the plaintiff were correct and were to say, I am entitled to attorney's fees under some other provision that the court somehow acted improperly or I'm entitled to attorney's fees, all that would mean is a remand back to the trial court, and the trial court's already made this finding. Plaintiff had no damages, sustained no damages, incurred no attorney's fees, incurred no costs. So all we're doing would be remanding back to the trial court to essentially say again, okay, they're entitled to costs or entitled to fees, and they have none.
All right, thank you, Mr. Drake. Your
time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Appreciate it. Mr. Krah, you have just over 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Certainly.
It is well settled that an award of attorney's fees is not contingent upon the obligation of the party to pay counsel.
That's the Ed A. Wilson case versus Government Services Association, 126 Federal 3rd, 1406, Federal Circuit, 1997. We don't have a similar rule here yet in Colorado law, but that case, if you read it, is based on good rationale and many other decisions. They say that Mr. Heiner had no damages. Your Honor, let's just flip that on its head. Did Drs. Johnson or Dr. King have any damages, or did Copic have damages? Isn't Copic litigating here to collect money that will go to them in the name, litigating in the name of Drs. King and Johnson so that they can recover money that won't go to King and Johnson, but that'll go to them? Would Copic give the money to King and Johnson? I think we all know the answer to that question. How can they argue here with a straight face, then, that the plaintiff, Mr. Heiner, wasn't damaged? I guess it's because no good act or no good deed will go unpunished. If the lawyers are foolish or nice enough to fund the litigation, to fight this kind of litigation abuse by Copic, they ran D-Quick into bankruptcy. If the lawyers are decent enough or foolish enough to spend $100,000 of their money to get this issue before an appellate court, well, I think that they have a lot of nerve coming in and standing before you trying to recover money for Copic, litigating in the names of Drs. King and Johnson, because that's exactly what they're doing. And that's why the government services case says that this is well settled. In every car accident case, when State Farm wins a judgment in a car accident, they go after costs. And they go after them in the name of their insured, but the insured doesn't get the money back. It goes to State Farm. This happens all the time in our jurisprudence. And there's no basis to that.
Mr. Croft, thank you. Your time is up.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you. I'd like to extend the court's thanks to both sides for their arguments today. This case will stand submitted, and an opinion in it will issue in due course. I remind counsel that we have asked for supplemental briefs, no more than 7 pages, within 5 working days. With that, everyone please drive safely home, and this court will stand adjourned today.